Anyway, during the millennial reign, what we'll have is what we described to you earlier. You'll have two kinds of nations. You'll have the sheep nations and the goat nations. And the goat nations will receive the curses, just like what we described in Psalms here. And the sheep nations will receive the blessings. And what you'll see progressively occurring in world history is you'll see the sheep nations growing and getting stronger and more powerful and more of them, and the goat nations gradually diminishing and wasting away and being destroyed. So that is the conception of the millennium that's on the part. And then, of course, you'll have regions of the world, like in America, for instance, where everybody's prosperous, you know, all material, nobody goes hungry or don't have to go hungry, all your needs are met. And then you have other places of the world like Bangladesh or Cambodia, places where they have false religions, where people are starving to death, they're massacring one another all the time, you know, where you see the curses manifesting itself. So, you know, this is the vision that the 19th century theologians had, okay, God's blessing us now in America. Let's go to these other countries and make them Christian too, and depose their governments if necessary, and turn them into Christian countries so they can begin to receive the blessings too. Where we've gone wrong is first, we lost our faith with the fundamentalists, our confidence, we lost our faith among the fundamentalists. The liberals lost their faith that the Bible was even real, and so we lost our blessings. And then we started exporting our apostasy with our missionaries. So our mission work today is really a curse to these nations. It's more of a curse than a blessing. Because all they are is just gimme, gimme, gimme. They want more aid from America. More missionaries, you know, more tourists, whatever it takes to bring it in, you know.
Each one of these countries. Right?
Yes, they get an opportunity to hear
right.
The gospel.
There's certain things that they, you know, that has to happen, or does happen because of what they've done.
Right, and if you read Romans chapter 1 and chapter 2, you'll see Paul bringing this out. He says the gospel goes to the Jew first, then to the Gentile. Then the judgment comes. Judgment comes first to the Jew, and then to the Gentile. See, and it happened that way. The Jews were destroyed in 70 AD. Judgment did come to the Jews, and it came later to the Gentiles. And it did come to the Gentiles. So that we see this constant flow in history, and of course we look at things from our point of view of our short lifespans, but when you begin to see history, and from the point of view of faith in the Word of God, you begin to see that God is working out His plan in world history.
Do you think, let's say there's only 10 righteous people in that nation, you know, like in the United States, is God going to pass judgment?
At some point, God does have to judge. Because if God's people cannot make a difference, if we're not no longer in physically in control anymore, then Jesus Christ has to intervene with His judgments. And whether it's natural calamity, whether it's bringing insanity to the minds of rulers, that's one way of God judging the people, is by giving them insane rulers. Self-destruct. You know, and we're reaching that point now. What's important is for God's people to restore the foundations and start over again. And that's what we'll look at when we get done with our break here, is taking a look at the scrolls and how the early Christians were basically rebuilding Israel, is what they were doing, refounding Israel at that time. Before we can understand a lot of prophecies in the Bible and understand how the Dead Sea Scrolls look at the prophecies of the Bible, it's important that we get an understanding of three kinds of prophecy, and this would be included underneath that final point on the first page there on the covenantal view of prophecy. There's basically three kinds of prophecy. So I get my notes out here. I'm going to write down three different kinds of prophecy in the Bible, and these are just theological terms. The first is called telic, T-E-L-I-C, and the second is called typical, and the third is conditional. These are three kinds of prophecies that you'll find in the Bible. Now, we're not talking about views of prophecy here. These are real prophecies. These are really in the Bible. Right. No, not the names, but these kinds of prophecies are really in the Bible. They're not views of prophecy. They are the kinds of prophecies that are actually in the Bible. And I'll describe them to you, because I think as you've read the Bible, you'll realize that there's different kinds of prophecy. For instance, the kind of prophecy that's talked about in the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses says that there shall be a prophet who will rise among you, and if he was inaccurate in any of his predictions, then you are to not hear and fear that prophet, because he's a false prophet. But then you'll find that there are some seemingly prophecies in the Bible that don't happen. You know, like Jonah, and, you know, the prophesying to Nineveh. Now, by the Mosaic standards, he would be considered a false prophet because he prophesied that Nineveh would be destroyed in 40 days, and it didn't happen. There was something that happened in the interim there. And so, what we're going to do here is this: that first kind of prophecy that we find that Moses warns about in Deuteronomy is the telic kind of prophecy. This is the kind of prophecy that's going to happen no matter what, because there is going to be a providential occurrence that will make it happen, all right? God is going to intervene in the situation, and something is going to happen to make that prophecy be fulfilled. Now, for instance, an example of this that we find in the Bible is in the book of Genesis, chapter 15, Abraham has his vision. God tells him that his descendants are going to be captives in Egypt for 400 years. Or rather, after 400 years, after being in Egypt, they are going to return to this land that God has promised Abraham, and God will give it to them. All right, now that was a telic prophecy. God gave him a specific year. It was 400 years. This was going to happen. Now, the children of Israel entered the land of promise, as we find in the book of Joshua, 430 years after that prophecy was given to Abraham. But there was something that happened that made it 430 years. And that was, God delivered them from Egypt ahead of schedule, 390 years later. But there was a disobedient generation that had to die off. And they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, and then they were allowed to go in. But God fulfilled his end of the bargain by his providential intervention. And there was no way that he was going to let them nullify his promise to Abraham. And so God brought them in one way or another, even if he had to raise up another generation. They had been delivered from Egypt on schedule, actually ahead of schedule. But they weren't brought into the land ahead of schedule. They could have. And I sometimes think that God allowed those 10 years there as a period of time of the actual warfare that would have taken place in Canaan as they were going around fighting the wars to bring them and destroy them. Because as it turned out, the Israelites, when they did go in, they fought all these wars with Joshua, but there were still major pockets of Canaanites that had not been driven out yet. And so I think that if the Israelites had been obedient in the beginning, they may have driven out those pockets of resistance. because he still would have had Moses, and he still would have had Joshua, see. But in this case, you only have Joshua, and yeah, you had a new generation that was raised up that was willing to go in and take the land, but, you know, they may not have been as strong. You know, maybe they were there at the Red Sea, but they were still young at the Red Sea. So, you know, there's a lot of factors coming into play there you wonder about, but what we are sure of is that this prophecy did happen. It was fulfilled, and that was because of providential intervention. And there are lots of prophecies like that in the Bible. Now, there's another prophecy, which I call typical, because that's more of a familiar term that we use when we say that the Bible teaches in types or symbols. We are saying that the kinds of prophecies that we have here are called ecbatic prophecies. What we're seeing in them is a historical parallel. In other words, a certain type of a person is fulfilling a certain type. For instance, the Philistines were always at war with the Israelites, because the Philistines, that was what they are. They were just being Philistines. Now, an example of a biblical type, and the Philistines were, you know, a type of individual in the Bible there. Prominent prophecy in the Bible has to do with the abomination of desolation. We know that there were at least two abominations of desolation, abominations that caused desolation, to be more accurate, according to Luke. Abominations that caused the desolation. One was during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. That was during the time in between the Old Testament and the New Testament, when the Jews had been returned to Jerusalem after Ezra, you know, and Nehemiah. They'd rebuilt a second temple, and this ruler, the Syrian ruler, decided that all the Jews ought to become Greeks. And so he goes in and starts this program of trying to do that, and he offers a pig as a sacrifice in the altar of the temple of God. And that's what started the Maccabean revolt, because the high priest of Maccabees his name slips my mind all of a sudden, but anyway, he and his seven sons leave Jerusalem, and they begin to fight a war against the Syrians. And so that's what that was all about. It was a refounding of the nation of Israel. And they did attain political independence at that time. So this would have been the time between Alexander the Great and the Romans, when the Romans came in. For about 100 years or so, the Jews governed themselves. And that was because they fought this major war. And what set that off was an abomination of desolation. And then the other one that happened was in 70 A.D. There was another abomination of desolation. And Jesus talks all about all this in Matthew 24. He recognizes that there was an abomination of desolation before, but he says that there's going to be another one again, and this one was in 70 A.D. There was something that was done that created a war that brought about the destruction of that political people of the Jews at that time, just like during the Maccabees. They came and destroyed all the people that had been, all the Jews that had joined Antiochus in his apostasy. They killed all of them and destroyed all those people and set up a new Israel. And so Jesus says there's going to be another abomination of desolation that's going to cause this thing to happen all over again. So what we see here is a historical parallel, not identically, not identically the same, but you're seeing history repeating itself. Right. Well, what you would want to look up would be the apocryphal books. Yeah. apocryphal books are the ones that you would want to get, because they have the first and second Maccabees, which gives you a lot of that history there. And then Josephus would be an important one to get, and then to a lesser extent, Philo was another Jewish writer at that time that provides a lot of information about those times. So actually, to get a little bit ahead of myself here, the Apocrypha gives us the Jewish, if you allow me to use the word Jewish, maybe I should say Israelite, the Israelite story to the time of the Romans. But then after the Romans arrive, that's where the Dead Sea Scrolls come in. They fill in a gap there that was not provided. Of course, Josephus writes a lot about it, but the Dead Sea Scrolls have brought a lot of illumination to that time period there, leading up to the time of Christ and in the early years of Christ's coming. But we'll get into that in a little bit. But anyway, so that's an example of the second kind of prophecy. Those kinds of prophecies, it's sort of like they're based upon observation. Like when Moses, God tells Moses, these people are going to harden their neck and they're going to completely turn away from me, and I'm going to have to drive them out of this land and completely scatter them. He tells that to Moses. We normally associate those predictions of exile with Isaiah or Jeremiah or some of those other prophets. But God told that to Moses in Deuteronomy, that God was going to eventually have to drive these people out of this land I'm giving them and make them exile among the nations. So how was he able to know this? Well, he could tell that these were a stiff-necked and rebellious people. Eventually, he was going to have to do it. They weren't going to change their ways. He was taking them into the land of Canaan despite them. In spite of the way they were, he was giving them this to fulfill the promises made to the fathers. But he knew he was eventually going to have to drive them out because of their sin. So anyway, there we have, a historical parallel that's taking place there. And actually, there were two driving outs. There was the time that happened under Nebuchadnezzar, and then there was another one that happened in 70 AD when they were driven out of the land. Is there going to be another one? We'll see. I tend to think there might be another one, because they're not going there to Israel as Christians. They're going in there trying to restore this old system, this old priestly sacrificial system, and not acknowledging Jesus Christ. The Jews may get driven out of Palestine again, just like they were before. It's sad. It shouldn't have to be that way. But, everybody's getting worked up over these prophecies that seemingly are being fulfilled. Well, these are typical prophecies here. We're not dealing with the telic prophecies. But we're also getting into this realm of the conditional prophecy here, which I need to describe to you, because the conditional prophecies are, properly speaking, the ones that have to do with the covenant, all right? And God promises blessings and cursings if you obey or disobey. Now, what happened, here's an example of one of these kinds of prophecies. The one with Jonah is an example, the one I just mentioned to you all before. Now, that prophecy wasn't stipulated as a conditional prophecy, but it was understood by Jonah as a conditional prophecy. He knew that if these people repented, God would relent. And sure enough, he did. So in his mind, it was a conditional prophecy. It looked like a telic prophecy, but it was really one of these. Also, so consequently, he was not a false prophet. But he was afraid he was going to be considered a false prophet, because he knew it wouldn't happen what he said. But another example would be the drought that Elijah prayed, that there would be a drought in Israel. You remember the story there. There was no rain in Israel for 3.5 years. Well, that was because, Elijah could look in the law of God and he could see God was going to cause drought to come upon the land because of their disobedience. And he could look and see Israel was disobedient, and so he was going to pray and make it happen. God, don't let it rain. And it didn't rain for 3.5 years. And Ahab thought it was Elijah's fault. He wanted to kill Elijah because he thought Elijah was the one that brought trouble upon Israel. And so he sent men out to kill Elijah. Elijah told Ahab, it's not me, it's you. You're the ones that have led the Israelites off into rebellion against God. It's not me. Sure, I may have prayed that God would enforce his sanctions against your disobedience, but, you know. And then, when the time came for it to rain, Elijah goes up into the mountain to start to pray, and he keeps praying, and he keeps praying, and as soon as he sees that little cloud, remember the story, with the size of a man's hand, Elijah tells him to get the message to Ahab, you better hurry up and get home, because it's going to rain. You know, there was a prophecy there that was based upon his knowledge of God, his knowledge of God's plan, you see. He knew that, I mean, this was after the fire from heaven incident, you know, killing of the priests of Baal and all of that. So there are different kinds of prophecy in the Bible, and you have to sometimes sort out which ones you're dealing with in order to avoid confusion. So anyway, when you look at these things that are, for instance, either in the Bible or in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you'll see a lot of biblical types being used. The symbolism. You'll have to understand, well, what do those symbols mean? And you have to realize that history can repeat itself. And you have to realize what's God's overall goal. You know, eventually, God is going to wrap this thing up. So we know what has to happen eventually. But getting there's going to be a lot to deal with, and God has plenty of time. It doesn't matter a twit to God whether it's the year 2000. What matters to him is whether his goals are being fulfilled in human history or not. Well, to look at these Dead Sea Scrolls, kind of help you out a little bit with them. As you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls were some scrolls that were found in the late 1940s, principally in the area that is also called Qumran, that is just north and east of the Dead Sea. In fact, that area is called the Wilderness of Judea, and it's right there at the Dead Sea. You make your descent from Jerusalem down to the Dead Sea, which is below sea level, and there's this plain down there, and it's completely desert, and there's caves, lots of caves, those rocks, little bluffs and mountains down there. And in those caves were where these scrolls were found. Now, these areas were inhabited at one time. Now, you begin to wonder, well, if it was inhabited, what did they eat? Where did they get their food? Well, it was obviously imported. It was brought in. Because what Qumran was kind of like, it was sort of like a retreat, what we would maybe consider a retreat or a monastery. It was an area where the spiritual leaders of Israel lived, and it was sort of like a theological center where they did their studying, their praying. And in fact, during the time of the apostasy that was occurring under the Pharisees and the Sadducees, a lot of the people, the leaders, for instance, those who were the descendants of the priests, Levites, such as John the Baptist, the Bible tells us he was in the wilderness until his appearing into Israel. Well, that's where he was. He was in the wilderness of Judea, where these people were at. These people were driven out of power driven out of the temple by Herod and his associates and by the Romans. And so what they did was, is actually they set up kind of they carried on, it was almost like a tabernacle in the wilderness. They became the temple in exile. So a lot of your religious rites that were supposed to be done under the law of Moses were being performed out there at this place in the wilderness in Qumran, just like the tabernacle with Moses in the wilderness. That's what they were doing. Now, what they were also doing out there was, as they were trying, with this apostasy that had occurred with the rise of Herod the Great and the sect of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, these people were trying to start a new Israel, start it all over again. And we're going to look at how they did that in just a minute. But in order to appreciate this idea of, actually a radical idea of calling the Dead Sea Scrolls Christian documents, let me explain what that means. If you get your concordance out sometime and you look up the word Christian, you'll find that the word Christian is probably used only maybe two or three times in the New Testament. Now, it tells us in the book of Acts that in Damascus, the Christians were first called Christians there in Damascus. But when you read that story there in Acts, it was that is sort of an editorial footnote or insert in the text, meaning that like what you would find in the Old Testament, like it would say, this city Jacob called Bethel, but it used to be called this, but now it's called Bethel. And so there's this little editorial in the text explaining to the people who are reading the text, when you say Bethel, where is that? Well, that used to be this city here, and you'll find that in the text. Well, in the book of Acts, this was an editorial insert to tell us that it was at Damascus where they were first called Christians. But that doesn't mean that was the time they were first called Christians, because the terminology Christian did not really begin to occur until late in the ministry of Paul, in the late 50s, early 60s, when he was first, and it was used by the Gentiles or the unbelievers to describe Christians. It wasn't the word the Christians used for themselves. So what I'm trying to say is when you look at the New Testament, you look at the names that the Christians used to describe themselves. What are some of the names that you can think of? A lot of Paul's epistles. What does he write? He uses saints, doesn't he? Servants. Okay. In some of the epistles, maybe not necessarily in Paul's epistles, you'll find the elect or the chosen ones. So there were a lot of different terms that Christians used to describe themselves, but they never referred to each other as Christians. Never in the entire New Testament do Christians refer to themselves as Christians, which is an interesting thought. That was a term that was used to describe them by the unbelievers, but not for them to describe themselves. So the first thing that we have to think about when we look at, actually, one of the terms that they are known of also, the sons of light. If you were a Christian leader, you were referring to yourself as an apostle, but when you were writing to other Christians, like Paul was writing to other Christians, he would generally refer to them as saints, the saints of God in Corinth or whatever. So anyway, they were known as Christians by others, but in the beginning they weren't even known as that. They were known as the sect of the Nazarenes. And that was how they were identified by their adversaries in Jerusalem. The Pharisees and the Sadducees referred to them as the sect of the Nazarenes. In Acts chapter 9, I think verse 2, I got that correct. They had another name that they described themselves as. Let's see if I've got that. That would be Acts 9:18. No, I'm sorry, it is not Acts 9:2. Can you read that? What does it say? Okay. This is the term that was used to describe their faith was the way. Okay? That was an important term that was used to describe each other as. And herein we begin to find the link between the Dead Sea Scrolls and early Christianity. Because the writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls referred to themselves as followers of the way and also followers of the New Covenant. And there were other explicitly Christian terms that they used. What scholars call the Qumran sect that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls in comparison to Christianity, some of the rites and doctrines that they have both met every day for a sacred meal of bread and wine, to which only the members were admitted to. They both practiced community sharing of property, which was most unusual for Jews at that time. You remember the story in Acts chapter 2 and elsewhere where it talks about that they had all things in common. They both valued celibacy, the Qumran sect very strongly, the Christians moderately. Both used baptism as a method of initiation. Both looked forward to a coming apocalyptic crisis, which would usher in a new messianic age. They used the same names for themselves. They both called themselves the Way, the New Covenant, the Sons of Light. Both had a branch in Damascus, again using the name the Way. They were governed by bishops who had similar functions in both cases. Each lived in expectation of a new Jerusalem with an identical architectural plan. You'll find one in the book of Revelation, and you'll find another in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where they were both four square with three gates on each side for the 12 tribes. That is also an important correlation between the two groups. They used numerous terms in common which closely parallel passages in both sets of literature, which we're going to look at some in a few minutes, as I copied one of the documents to look at here. Of course, there are differences between the two groups, which we can look at later if time permits. But I'm going to try to isolate some interesting highlights that is found in the what is called by scholars the Community Rule. That was one of the scrolls that were uncovered. And for instance, in the opening statements, it refers to the holy ones, which is the same word for saints. Okay, that the instructor is to teach the holy ones or teach the saints. He's to teach them to seek God with all their heart and with all their soul. Calls them the children of light, who are in. We're fighting against the children of darkness. They again refer to them as sons of light. Here's some interesting statements here. It says, to quote, "For only through the Spirit pervading God's true society can there be atonement for man's ways. All of his iniquities thus only can he gaze upon the light of life and so be joined to his truth by his Holy Spirit. So now we have here a reference to the Holy Spirit. It says, only through the Holy Spirit purified from all iniquity. Through an upright and humble attitude, his sin may be covered. And by humbling himself before all God's laws, his flesh can be made clean, etc. They refer to hell's outer darkness. They refer to a day of visitation, which Jesus referred to a day of visitation. We'll come back to that later. They talk about circumcising the foreskin of their nature, the stiff neck, and so establish a foundation of truth for Israel. Of course, I told you that they refer to this covenant they were making as a new covenant. This is an interesting regulation of this in this community rule. Here it says, also no man is to bring a charge against his fellow before the general membership unless he has previously rebuked that man before witnesses. So we find that correlated to Matthew 18, where Jesus tells them, if your brother offends, take witnesses to him, to confront him first, before taking him to the entire congregation. No. It refers to the communion meal where it says, for drinking it is the priest who shall stretch out his hand first, blessing the first portion of the bread or the new wine. And